From the Ground Up is all about us learning with you, with all these experts that we are bringing in on, from simple strategies to the most advanced property strategies. These people are all successful in what they do and have so much information to share to you, and we cannot wait for you to listen.
That's great to have you on board, mate. I guess just giving everyone a little bit of an introduction to yourself, like where you started in your business journey in the property scene and what you're currently up to right now.
So I'm Shaz, and I have my own property finance brokerage. So essentially, I help investors when they need funding for their deals, because investment funding really isn't something you find on the high street. It's quite specialist. So you need someone like me to work those deals, you know, kind of be creative and make things happen. I've had my business since August 2022, but I've been in the business for over a decade now. And I like to dabble in different things. I like doing what I call side quests, you know, hosting an event every now and then, doing some videography, doing some content creation. That's kind of all funnels in then to people wanting to work with me.
Yeah, love it. Yeah, social media is such a powerful thing. I can't wait to ask questions on that, because I have a load of questions on how that's helped your business. I know you're prominent on that. So how did you get into like property finance in the first place? Like, what made you go down that route?
I guess it's all down to fate, really. I've always worked for like banks and big corporates. So I used to work for Lloyds Bank before in a call center, but that was more just like, you know, what's my balance? It was more of a sales role, you know, just check someone's balance, offer them a credit card and that kind of thing. And then two of my good friends, and we're friends now, they left to go to Barclays, and they were nagging me like, Shaz, come on, let's go. I was like, nah, I was comfortable. It was quite monotonous, but I was comfortable, no real ambition. I was like, no, guys, I'm fine. But they were nagging me all the time. I was like, fine, let me at least have an interview and just see what this Barclays mortgage role looks like. Barclays did the interview, you know, was successful. But the big thing with Barclays and big benefit was they would also pay for my CMAP qualification. So you need a qualification to be giving mortgage advice. I believe we were the last batch of people where they actually paid for your qualification. So got lucky there. And went to Barclays. But again, to be fair, that was also a call center. It wasn't nothing like what I do now. That was more, you know, people calling in, because Barclays, everyone knows the brand. People calling in, wanting a new deal or existing deals, and we help them. It wasn't creative, definitely more customer servicey as opposed to being creative. I would say, not to be negative, it was quite like order taking with good customer service. But then they made us redundant, which wasn't the end of the world. I remember people who had been there for like 10, 15 years were panicking. They were like, oh my God, what are we going to do? I was like, guys, first of all, you got 6 months gardening leave. You got a lot of money coming in. Also, you've been there 10, 15 years. You got a lot of money coming in. Yeah, I've only been there 3 years, so I'm getting nothing, but you've been there a long time. And you're qualified. You got CMAP, right? You're going to get like, you already got a qualification. You'll find a job easy. So during that gardening leave, I set up like a small food business. But then when that gardening leave finished, I was quite bored. I was like, I need to do something. So that's when I got into the world of specialist finance, specialist mortgages, took on an employed role, and then eventually went self-employed.
Yeah, that's awesome. With like, when you say specialist finance, a lot of people listen to this, like, what is the difference between going to like a broker to buy a note? I was like, why would someone come to you specifically for finance or a specialist broker in the first place? What do you
help with? Great question. Get asked a lot. I think there's definitely benefits to using a broker. First of all, if you go to, let's say you go to Lloyds Bank and you want to look at mortgage options, they'll give you their options, and that's all they're trained to do. But what they're not going to say is, by the way, also Barclays got a much better deal. Maybe just have a chat with them. They're not incentivized that way. Whereas a broker will look at what you've got, and they're incentivized to work for you, for your benefits, and figure out from the whole market, you know, what you can do. I would say though, if what you're doing is pretty vanilla, and when I say vanilla, I mean you're employed, you've been in your job for a while, your deposit is your savings, you're buying a standard house, either to live in or even to rent out. It's just a standard thing. You could maybe get away with just, you know, compare the market and just pick a deal. It may not be the best one, maybe 10, 15 quid over the odds, but ultimately you could do it. But anything quirky or unusual. So this is even on residential mortgages, if you're self-employed, if you've got a bit of bad credit, if your deposit is from like mum and dad or something, you know, there's so many lenders out there. How do you know that this lender is the best one for you? And then even more than that, in the space that I operate in, so specialist finance, which is, I think, anything such as buy-to-lets, limited companies, you know, short-term lets, service accommodation, development finance, we're the wonderful things. These lenders that we work with, not even on the high street, you wouldn't know about them unless, you know, you've spoken to a broker. And a lot of those lenders need a broker in the middle anyway. They will only be able to be accessed through a broker because they'd rather not deal with clients. They want us to package and all that kind of stuff. So definite benefits there is one is they are working for you and not the lender. So they're looking at your interests. Two, you know, they can save you money sometimes by looking at maybe the best deals. It depends what best is. One thing people say sometimes is, do brokers get cheaper products or cheaper rates? I'm going to say no, they don't. I think what we get sometimes is maybe semi-exclusive. So a lender might say, look, we've got this new product. For the first 3 weeks, rather than get everyone flooding in, we'll just limit who we distribute this product through. But then after a month, we'll give it to everyone. So that sometimes happens. But generally, we don't get lower rates than everyone else. It's more about relationships. And that's the other thing as well is all of these lenders, they pay, you know, these business development managers who travel up and down the country, meet brokers, and there's relationships that are built. And ultimately, if things in your application go wrong or there's kind of a policy that needs to be slightly flexed for you, that's only going to happen if your broker has got that relationship with that business development manager. So loads of benefits. There's a lot of firefighting that we do that no one knows about in the background. You know, loads of back and forth emails. And ultimately, you get your mortgage offer and you deal with solicitors, which is the worst part of the process, I believe.
Yeah, I guess the power is getting stuff over the line, right? That maybe someone would struggle to get over the line otherwise. Like, I mean,
yeah, absolutely.
We in a small kind of way saw this ourselves. Like when we bought the house refurbing, our business was less than 2 years old, right? Yeah. So suddenly, like, that was confusing. Plus, Zach's obviously on a visa as well from Australia. So we had a few different variations in there that suddenly it wasn't like a simple.
And it ran out a month before our mortgage was going to come in and we were going to complete.
Oh, God.
So it was just like, we got there, but like it was like a fearful moment. We're like, we're not going to get a mortgage, but the interest was like way higher.
Yeah, I bet. But you know, had you gone in with your situation to just the main banks, again, Lloyds, Barclays, HSBC, whoever, they wouldn't want to know. But and again, if you had tried to do that yourself, after the fourth no, you might be like, oh, this is not going to happen. However, when you speak to a broker, they'll be like, hang fire, guys, I'll find you the lender, I'll do it. Here's your options.
Yeah,
yeah, exactly. It's like a hands off kind of experience. And yeah, I think if we were to do that ourselves from like a low end, just like on a normal like residential for ourselves, I can't even imagine what that would be like on like a bridge or developed finance or anything that's like an investment where you got like a lot more money on the line as well. What would be like the three things, because we just mentioned a few there, but the three things that would limit someone being able to get finance if they're just starting their property journey.
So one perhaps is bad credit, but I think it's worth defining for people what bad credit is. And I always find the ones who think they've got bad credit, actually it's not that bad. But the ones who think their credit's amazing are the ones who've got issues that they need to be telling people about. So if you've got a couple of late payments on a credit card or a utility bill, you may think, oh, it's horrendous, what am I going to do? But actually, especially on buy-to-let or investment mortgages, lenders kind of can ignore it, depending on what the reason is, and as long as it's all up to date now, because it's just an unsecured credit facility, they can just be fine with it. What lenders don't like is things like CCJs, so county court judgments. I go on about this all the time. In this country, it's so easy to get a CCJ. If you get a parking ticket and you think, you know what, it's a private parking ticket, they can't find me, I've watched Watchdog, it's not going to happen. You know, they can send you a few letters and apply for a CCJ. You ignore that letter, you get a CCJ on your record, and that lasts for 6 years. So CCJs, I wouldn't say they're common, but when they happen, it does impact you for 6 years. Bankruptcy, obviously criminal records are shown in your credit file as well. But so keep it on top of your credit file. I think, again, people look at things like the credit score and they'd be like, I've got 999. That's great. But what it's being mindful of is, you know, Experian, Equifax, TransUnion, the three major agencies, that number they give you is just an internal number. It's not something that is generically recognized. What's more important is your conduct. So that's the first thing is credit files. And it's not just, again, bad credit. The other thing to keep on that same topic is your address history and where you're registered to vote. Lenders obviously want you to be registered where you live in. And that needs to be updated on, say, your credit card, your bank statements, and your phone bills to make sure it's all in. So credit is very, very important. I think the other thing that falls down on a lot of the investors as well, especially, is their source of funds and evidencing that. So mortgage lenders are fine with gifts from family. So mum, dad, brother, sister, they can give you a gift as long as mum, dad, family can evidence where they got their money from. But investors will do that, but also they'd be like, yeah, I've got, you know, 25 grand from an unsecured loan from a third-party investor that I got from Instagram, got 15 grand from Facebook and this and that. Now, that is kind of okay. So investment lenders, you know, bridging lenders are kind of okay with that as long as you can evidence that where that money's come from. So they do anti-money laundering checks and the investor usually has to sign the deed of subordination. It has to be an unsecured loan. You can give them a personal guarantee. So proving the source and proof of funds is very important. That's number two. And what else? I think it's just not being open and honest with your broker about your situation. I always say to people, tell me the weird and wonderful stuff first. So, you know, So what happens is, especially in our world, which is, you know, investment finance, people will become deal sources or they'll start doing rent-to-rent. And that works really well. So for 6 months, they're making a lot of money. And now they're like, you know what? I've quit my job, Shaz. I'm full-time in property. Great. But now you need to evidence your on-paper income and you've not been self-employed enough to now have a tax calculation generated yet. Not the end of the world. Yeah. Suddenly that just limits your range of lenders to from like, you know, 80 to maybe seven. Like you want to be able to have the pick of lenders. So there is that gray period when people switch their job kind of status and don't have the on-paper proof of what their income is.
Yeah, well, that's what we faced. And at that time, Zach still had his job. So that then helped. But otherwise, it was tricky, wasn't it?
Mm. Yeah, exactly. We're in that period right now because our business is under 2 years, technically. So if we were to go get our house it would be like very difficult. I mean, you would know that. You'd probably say it'd be very hard, which is not ideal. But you know what? Going back to what you said about the not the utilities, but the place for registration, I think it's so easy because we've moved a few times in the last years. It did get flagged up on one of ours that, like, even though I hadn't changed our place of registration because we move like twice in a year. So easy just to forget to like update your address on like multiple different things. And then all of a sudden, it's just like, oh, crap. It's like, you've got like 20 things you need to change.
Yeah, I think you say it's easy to forget, but also it's easy to do it as well. You just go online and you can change about your address quite easily. And the other thing to be mindful of with that, not to scare people, is if there's inconsistencies with the information that's been entered on a lender's application and they do a credit search, and if that happens 3 or 4 times in a short space of time, there is a risk of being flagged up as potential like anti-fraud checks because there's inconsistencies. Mm. It's happened a few times. You know, you've gone to one lender, you go to someone else, go to someone else, same issue happens, and it could end up, there is a list called the Hunter's List, and that's when you end up on a mortgage blacklist, basically. So I've seen it happen before. I'll give you a quick example. So we had a client, they were doing a buy-to-let with us, and they went to, I think it was Santander Direct to do their residential kind of mortgage. There were some inconsistencies with the data. I think the Santander application, because they did it online and then on the phone, where their income, for example, was like £24,037 per annum, it was entered as 24K, rounded down, whereas we entered the exact figure. And there was little things like that and months here and there. And that flagged up as anti-fraud. They were blacklisted for a couple of months. In the end, they managed to rectify it, but it can happen and I've seen it happen.
That's interesting. And that's over like really small things. That's not big stuff, right? So it's... Mm-hmm. There's a lot of details involved, like £37, did you say, or something? That's crazy.
So is it just like an AI, like, is it like an AI system that's just like flagging it up and then just blacklisted and it's just not, they just like leave it. They're just like black and white. Like, that's it.
No, I wouldn't say it's AI. It is definitely kind of manual. They all these lenders, when they do their credit checks and their searches, they'll report into a central system. And if there's too many inconsistencies and there's patterns of behavior and things, then you get flagged up. But the good thing is you can go back and look to, you know, overturn it. But do you want that stress? Ultimately, no.
No, you don't. You want it simple. Yes.
Mm. So let's get into some property, more creative strategies and things like that. So talk to us a little bit about, like, you kind of listed them before, like development finance, things like that. Tell us about those main strategies. Let's just break it down for people that are kind of starting out, and then we can kind of dive into them a bit more.
Sure. So the things people come to me with is, first of all, when they are buying property. So anything that's like rent to rent, I wouldn't need to be involved with. But you've got your standard single buy to let, tenant on AST, rent it out. You've got your short-term let or service accommodation. So it's no ASTs. You're doing maybe Airbnb or some sort of portals or your own website. You've got HMOs, house of multiple occupancy, where maybe there's three or four or more unrelated people in a property. Very, very popular right now. Within that now, very popular, but I can see it kind of going tits up, is the whole social housing thing. So you're getting government contracts, guaranteed rent, no voids, no repairs, house gets given back to you. The problem I'm seeing with a lot of these contracts now is lenders would prefer you to have the contract directly with the government. But a lot of these people in the middle are going to be greedy. And instead of taking like a sourcing fee, they want to be the ones in the middle with a contract with the landlord. Then they have the contract with the provider. But ultimately, from a lending perspective, who is this middle person? What's their track record? How are they even guaranteeing the rent? What if they do a runner? It's causing a few problems. You've got multi-unit blocks, so multiple flats on one title. Those are the main things that we're getting on the mortgage side of things. And then, of course, you've got your short-term deals. If you're doing buy, renovate, refinance, you've got bridging, you know, refurbishment, development. And there's a lot you can do. I think because there are so many lenders, all who are funded differently, you can be creative. You can get into deals with very little money in, or pull all your money back out. When people say, I've got a free house, it's not really a free house. It just means you've pulled your money back out from your initial investment.
Yeah. I mean, you could have an episode on every single one of these, right? So much.
100%.
It's so dense.
You mean the surface massively.
Yeah. So like when you talk about developer finance and then and bridging, like can you explain those a little bit more? Because they're ones I'm really intrigued to learn a lot more about. I know other people would be, because I know that a lot of developers float them out. And sometimes I hear it, I'm like, don't know the difference.
Sure. So short-term finance, first of all. So if you've got a property that's good to rent out straight away within a couple of weeks, get a mortgage and ways. If you've got a property that would be classed as like a project, you're going to buy a property, go back to brick, turn it to something else, or you're buying land and you can build something from scratch into that, or anything that where your plan is to keep it empty for a period of time, spend the money to add further value to it, and then refinance in the short term to pull your money back out. You then need short-term finance, and that's what we call bridging or development or refurbishment. So with these lenders, they can take a lot more risk and they can be a lot more creative, but it does cost a lot more. So where a mortgage might be 5.5% per annum, bridging is about 1% per month. However, you're not on it for that long. You're on it for 6, 9, 12 months. Mm-hmm. Ideally, no more than you pay back and then crack on with your mortgage. Typically, you get normally 75% against the initial purchase price. However, that's the gross loan. You don't normally see all of that money up front. So with bridging, there's three ways to pay the interest. You can either service the interest, which means you set up a direct debit and you pay this interest each month. I don't see that very often, because unless you're buying something that's tenanted at auction, if it is a refurbishment or a development you're doing, it suddenly means you're going to have to pay your builders and your suppliers, and you're gonna have to find like £1,000 a month, you know, whatever. It's not really convenient. But the benefit there is you are getting close to 75% in your bank. The second method is called rolled up interest. Now with these, you get 70% net in the bank. All the interest then is rolled, and you just pay at the end, depending on how long you've had the loan for. I think it sounds, in principle, it sounds great, but ideally you're paying from your profit, so you might end up being slightly overgeared because interest is added each month. And also what they don't tell you is interest is compounded. So month's interest suddenly is interest on top of that, on top of that, on top of that, as the months go on.
Yeah, right,
the most common method, and the most common method is retained interest. So with retained interest, let's say you agree a term of 12 months. The lender will work out, okay, fine, 12 months worth of interest is £10,000. Before they give you your 75% loan, they take 10 grand off. Your net loan is typically about 67-ish percent net in the bank. Now, yes, you're getting less money, but realistically, it's risk management because now you know and the lender knows that at no point are you going to be above the 75% because they factored in that interest element. People then say, well, if I pay the loan back early, will I get a refund? No, you will not. But what happens is, let's say you pay the loan back in 6 months. You'll pay back your net loan plus just 6 months worth of interest. So they adjust the redemption figure in line with how long you've had the loan for. But yeah, it's just, that's what bridging is. It's a short-term solution for you to get in and out of deals, to do creative deals. So if you went to a mortgage lender and you said, yeah, by the way, although I'm getting a mortgage and this property's current market rent is 700 quid, I'm actually going to have it empty for 6 months, do a full-on renovation and leave you, you know, after that, they're not going to lend. So the investors will say, well, I've done it, or my mate's done it, or it can be done. Probably it can be done, but it's by misleading the lender, which is mortgage fraud. I'm not the mortgage police. Do whatever you want.
You hear like horror stories, didn't you, about bridging, right? Like people getting stuck on their bridge for
Yes. Yeah. So let's go through that. So a couple of things people say about bridging. One is that it's expensive. Yes, it is definitely more expensive than a mortgage, but I guess the comparison isn't fair. It's a short-term loan rather than a 25-year mortgage. So not a fair comparison. Second thing is it's risky. You know, if I can't pay them back, let's say in 12 months, they'll repossess the property. They can, that's within the terms, but they would probably generally give you an extension because it costs them more to repossess than it would be to charge you a 2% extension fee and double your interest rate. So don't rely on the extension because it's going to suddenly cost you a lot more. But generally, I think in the 5 years or 6 years I've been in specialist finance, no repossessions, lenders are keen. As long as you keep them informed of what's going on, send them some pictures, tell them what's actually happening. Tell them what's happening 3 months before your loan is due to finish. They generally will work with you to make it work. In terms of being stuck on the bridge, that's more about project planning, isn't it? If you think the work was going to take 6 months, factor in 9 months. If you think the sale is going to take 3 months, factor in 6 months. Have that longer term.
Yeah.
And you know, you only pay for how long you've had it. I think when done well, bridging is great. It's a great tool to have in your toolbox. But I would definitely work with a broker for bridging because there are so many lenders out there. It can be a bit of a minefield.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. Bridging is one that is like, it's something that we're learning about as we keep talking to people. And just then, like, I didn't know about that second option where the loan interest actually accrues and it stacks up. So you're paying more every single month. I had no idea about that. That is like, that's one of those things where if you stack your deal, not thinking about it, it could be maybe like, we've talked about $4,000 or $5,000, but that could just completely make that deal not profitable if you've got like contingencies in there. So that's a good little nugget there. So that's bridging. So then, developer finance.
Yes.
Is this more long-term finance?
Again, it depends on the project. So I think development finance would be maybe when you are building out new units from scratch, or you convert a commercial building into residential. I would say it's just a word. It's just a way where you are getting money towards the cost of work as well. So how that would work typically is you can normally get, say, 75% against the purchase, and usually 11% of the cost of the work. But there's a few kind of caveats with that. So the money for the work is always paid in arrears in stages. So typically you have to do at least 30-35K's worth of work first. You then send over the invoices. They'll send an asset manager to visit to sign it off. And then you get the money back. It takes about a week. It'll cost you about 400-500 quid for each visit. Now, in order for you to get 100% of the cost of the work, you have to be increasing the value of the property enough. That's how they look at the project assessment. So they call it, so obviously you've got your GDV, which is your end value, and the cap that lenders have is loan to GDV, LTGDV. typically it will be up to 70% of the end value. So the total loan for the purchase and the work cannot be any more than 70% of the end value. Now, sometimes you may hit that cap. You know, your project may not be profitable from a cash out perspective, but for you, it's a HMO or it's multi-units, you'll get that back in rent. You're happy to have money left in. That's okay. And if you hit that cap, lenders will just reduce your day one loan. So you put in a larger deposit and you can have 100% of the works. They'd rather fund as much of the work as possible and make you put a bigger deposit in day one. But it's always in tranches.
Right.
A little nugget, as you said, Zach, is just be mindful of if you are using kind of refurbishment or development finance, of the valuation method when it comes to drawdowns. So most lenders will just give you money based on how much you spend, as long as you can evidence all of that. And that works really well. There are some lenders, I wouldn't say they hide it, but I think if you're an inexperienced broker, you may not explain to your clients that this is how it works, is some lenders will do what they call residual valuations. So what they say is they'll get a valuer out and say, look, what's the value of the property now? And they say, okay, fine, now we'll end up with 70% of that minus what they've currently got and do it that way. That's great on new builds because obviously if it's land, as soon as you start building, the value's going up. If you're doing like a back to brick refurb, it means for the first month, 2 months, the value's gone right down. So suddenly there's no money to pull out. Then you can, it's called like an S curve. The value goes right up. So you got to be careful with which way you do it.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting. It's definitely, that's probably the one we know the least about, right? Because it's not something that most people use unless, like you said, it's maybe a bigger project, more advanced type stuff.
Yeah, I think it's definitely better for new builds and things.
Yeah, so just for my, and I know a lot of people would be like listening to this and new wanting to know it. So you wouldn't pair, could you pair a bridge and loan, a developer loan together? There's no point. The developer loan does what the bridge basically does, but just a little bit like on steroids would be the best way.
Yeah, exactly. So on day one, I would go with a lender that will do both elements. So they'll do the bridging and the development all in one package, get your entitlements.
Yeah.
I'll be honest, you probably couldn't do it with two separate lenders because ultimately they will both want first charge or first ranking charge on company's house on the property. So yeah, go with one lender that will do both. And ultimately, yeah, when you are bridging, they want to know about your project. What are you planning to do? And they'll probably want to build in facility for that.
Yeah, okay, cool. You just said one thing that I think would be really great for you to explain. So like first, second, third charge for people that will, like, especially people that are going to investors. There's a lot of people that, I remember when I started, people like, oh yeah, I've got first charge in the building. And I was like, cool. No idea what that meant. I do know, but it'd be good for you to detail that.
So obviously you've got land registry, and on land registry, they'll have listed, you know, charges. Who's got a charge or a right over that property? Now, when you buy a property with a mortgage, you may say you own that property. And yeah, technically you do. However, if worse comes to worse and there's a repossession, who gets the proceeds of the sale? Well, actually, it's the first ranking charge holder, which in that case would be the mortgage lender. Now, sometimes, you know, mortgage lenders might only go to, say, 75%, or residential might go to 90%. There is scope. If you really squeeze more money out of that asset, you can look at what they call second charges. So there are a lot of specialist lenders who'll do what they call a second ranking charge. They'll charge you a lot more for it because it's more risk. And I think it is very risky because ultimately, if there is a repossession, you probably can't sell that asset at market value. You might sell it at auction at a 90-day value, or, you know, less than that. There probably wouldn't be enough to pay the second charge holder back anyway, right? But yeah, there are lenders who can do seconds. Thirds are not very common. But yeah, also in terms of charges, if you've got an investor who's funding your project, you know, what security are you going to offer them? You might give them a personal guarantee, but if you're a first-time landlord yourself, you've got no other assets or liabilities, your PG doesn't really mean much. So you could say, well, actually, you can have a charge on the project, and when I refinance, I'll pay you back. So yeah, when you are working with investors, you can offer them a first-ranking charge. Just be mindful that, if you're looking at lending, so you're looking at using a bridging lender or a development lender, often they may not allow someone to have a second charge behind them. So you've got to figure out, I think, yeah, if you're doing that, figure out who's going to actually have a charge, where they're going to sit. Is that going to work for both parties? But if you can't offer a charge, you can also offer like a an RX1, a restriction on sale, which means it can't be sold without that person's permission. Also, guys, just going back to bridging, because, yeah, horror stories and stuff, but and this might be a video for me to do on my own Instagram. People say, like, that, you know, I don't want to go with this specific lender because people in my mentorship community have said that this lender always changes the goalposts, always changes numbers, and I'm not comfortable. First of all, don't listen to other people, apart from your broker. Secondly, that lender or these lenders, multiple, they wouldn't be in business if they weren't lending money. That's the second thing. Third thing is, you people don't realize is, guys, these lenders, you know, they have staff, they have teams, but ultimately they make no money from you until the deal goes over the line and you pay them back. So that's just the context there. Yeah. Realistically, the only time things should change or could change is due to outside things. So first of all, especially if it's a refurb project. So first thing is the valuation. If you're saying you're going to buy something and you've secured it for £150,000, but the valuer goes out and says, yeah, probably looks great, but actually it's probably only worth £130,000. Well, that professional has been paid for their opinion. I get it. They might be wrong, but it's their professional opinion. The lender will go off the lower figure. So that's the first thing that could change what you get sent. Next thing is your cost of works. So you said your six-bed HMO scheme is going to cost £50,000 to do the conversion. The asset manager goes out and says, yeah, scheme looks good. Definitely we'll make a HMO. But really, they've not built in any contingency. And because the cost of goods are going up, this should now cost £75,000. Well, again, that needs to be built in to the scheme. Maybe reduce your loan. What I will say with that is if you still get it done for less money, great. You won't pay interest on what you don't use. But the lender will want to build it in because the professional that they've employed to do that job has said it's going to cost more. Thirdly is the end value. So again, if you said your scheme is going to end up with a six-bed HMO, and even on a bricks and mortar basis, you think it's going to be worth suddenly £250,000. But the valuer, the asset manager both agree, scheme is good, cost of works are good, but the end value is going to be probably £50,000 less. They're going to have to cap that because you probably hit the loan to GDV threshold that we mentioned earlier. So those are things that could affect what happens. Now, ultimately, that's not the lender changing the goalposts. That's not them. That's them relying on their professionals after the fact, right? There's nothing you can do because they had to pay those people. The other time things change is when you, as a client, don't disclose information that is quite important. I think of this like lending Miranda rights. You know, Miranda rights is when you say you have the right to appeal. If you don't use anything, yeah. If you don't tell the broker and the lender that you got bad credit and that comes out, or if you don't tell the lender or the broker that actually you are using third-party investor funds, which is nothing wrong with it, but it does weaken your position a little bit because now if you're using all investor funds for the deposit, you're putting no money in, you are seen as potentially a weaker client than someone who's putting money in themselves and has skin in the game. They could potentially say, look, we just want to minimize our risk. We might lower our loan to value, so on and so forth. So I think those are the two things. Those are the kind of, four things that could impact lending or have lenders change the goalposts. Ultimately, guys, they're in the business to lend. It's their business. They make money from lending money out. Yes, they might ask more questions than you think is reasonable, but that's their job.
I mean, it sounds like that's a lot to do with like preparation, right? And like due diligence and like setting those things like cost of works and stuff like that. Like what that sounds like to me is people just need to be really, really kind of educated and know what their plan is before they get into it, right? I mean, what things do you see people kind of missing out and not planning for? Or like what are the key things that people could be doing better in those kind of situations?
Yeah, sure. So first thing I would say is in your schedule of works, which you need to get prepared by your project manager or your builder, is make sure it has a contingency built in, 15 to 20% on top. It may have that, but if it is, make sure it's clearly labeled within that we have also factored this in. And on better than a schedule of works, try and get a fixed price contract so that if the asset manager does say the cost of work should be 10, 15 grand more, you can say, well, actually, I've got this fixed price contract. It's not going to change. And these guys have done a similar project, you know, 10 times already. So they'll definitely deliver. That doesn't always work, but, you know, it can. In terms of other things, I think it's just being, you know, worst case scenario with everything. So what's the worst case cost of works? What's the lowest conservative GDV? Those things will help you mitigate your risk. Ultimately, you may raise more money or put more money in the deal, but the deal doesn't exist unless you can get funding. So just work on worst case scenario and just tell your broker everything. Like, and also don't do silly things like exchange and then say, now I need to complete and now I'm in a rush. Like, try and get the lending first before you exchange.
There's some good nuggets there, man. I think what you said there about the Miranda ride is hilarious. It's like the thing that went in my head is, like, imagine just being able to take the fifth if a lender asks you a question you don't want to answer. I was like, this is my head's racing. I've learned so much from this. This has been absolutely awesome. There's one area I know that you are massively, like, huge on right now, and that's your social media. And I think I'd love to hear how that for your business, and how you think then that can help people grow their, like, property business as well. But first of all, like, talk about that, because we listened to you speech at one of the networking events, and you were massively talking about this. Talk about how you got into that and what that's done for yourself so far.
Yeah, cheers, Zach. So I'm smiling because I remember that speech. I remember my gimbal with the AI tracking, because I'm so animated with my hands, saw this and was like, stop tracking chats.
You did it. You stopped, and then I saw you do this. Like, you went to where you knew the camera was. You sat there the whole time.
I don't think that network was so high tech before. It was like,
I know.
But just for anyone, I was like a kind of following him around as he did his whole talk. It's very.
But I need to learn to keep my hand motions just a little bit lower, perhaps. Right. So I think. It's all social media and stuff. It's all good. I think when I lost my job, so I got sacked from mortgage brokerage. So when I got sacked and I went self-employed, ultimately I had no brand, no clients, no money, no hope, you know, so you have to do something to get people's attention. On top of that, you know, being a small firm in South Wales, a lot of the business is done in London or in the Midlands. I have to be a little bit extra, a little bit kind of more than just to get seen and get known. So, like, I'm not you. If I'm honest, my OG friends, when they see me, they're always like, "Shaz, you know, we can't believe you're doing what you're doing in terms of the social media. You know, we're really shy and quiet." And I'm like, "Yeah, I still am, but I just treat it like my job." Yeah. So when you have a job, you do whatever you're told to do and don't question it at all, right? So. Yeah, social media has been great. It's really helped my business. I wouldn't have half the business if I wasn't on Instagram or whatever. And the way I've approached it is purely just to give as much value as possible, not really be salesy. And if people want to work with you, great, because they'll really want to work with you because they think you're amazing. And if they don't, that's fine. They've got enough information. But then you also have those people in the middle who are now, they're not ready to do any business or whatever, but actually you're front of mind if something comes about because you've given them enough value to go ahead with. I started off doing a lot on Facebook, a lot of the Facebook groups, and you'd have people go in, you know, I need a mortgage broker. This is my situation. What do people think? And I would just chip in and I would actually say, look, maybe you want to try this lender, or maybe you want to actually, you know, give them actual answers and then say, if you want any more help, just let me know. And that was different at the time, because back then you'd have people asking the question. Then you'd have like 10 brokers just going, I can help, DM me, or I can help, phone me. Or you'd have people just going, tagging or trying to be like, I can make an intro to my broker for a referral fee. Let me know. So by giving answers and being valuable, it was different and it kind of got people's attention. I've kind of stepped back from Facebook a little bit. One, it's a little bit time consuming, but secondly, it's just full of noise. Same people, same faces, same people tagging. And I think I've got to a point where the lead generation stuff I've got is very passive. Now I get enough anyway. That's something that could just doesn't need to be there. With Instagram, there's a lot of content I put out. Videos, carousels, all this kind of jazz. I don't do those TikTok-y videos. I'm a bit too old for that now. But ultimately, it's about growing your brand. So, like, when people say to me, Shaz, you know, you're everywhere, the answer is, yeah, thanks, because that is the aim, is to be seen or be seen to be everywhere. I don't travel as much as it seems like I do, but I'm good at broadcasting. So if I'm at an event, the next week I'll post about the event. Like it'll seem like I'm just omnipresent, front of line, think mortgages. Oh yeah, that Shaz guy knows what he's on about. Let's speak to him.
Also,
I think I covered this in the presentation. I have seasons. I'll have periods where I'll just say yes to everything. Do you want to be on a podcast? Do you want to do this speaking? Do you want to come on our little mastermind? Yeah. Because it's all content and it's all like distribution. You know, you've got your audience who'll see this, who don't know who I am yet. And vice versa, you know, we'll share each other's stuff. And I think collaborations are really, really important as well. Work with people in your sector, even if they do the exact same thing that you do. So like I have a lot of other mortgage brokers, we collaborate together, because the way I look at it is your clients are your clients and your people are your people. So I could deliver the same kind of message with the same script to a group of people, so could another mortgage broker. We'd probably get half and half of the room because of our delivery and how we connect with people. So there's none of that kind of insecurity around, oh, he's going to steal my client or this and this, because I think people stealing clients is a two-way thing. The client also has to be open to be stolen, right? So if they are, they weren't going to be your client long-term anyway, so I'm happy to let things go. But what I would say to Akin, even, but it's not for me, it's not just built just to talk about it, it depends really well.
I see your audience going a bit, Shaz.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, now, yeah. That's better.
Sorry. So,
fine.
What's it, guys? So I think what I've done really well, if I look back, is the online and the offline. So, yes, social media, but I've also traveled up and down the country to every single event that I could go to for a period of time. That's where the whole Where's Shaz thing comes from. And I think that's super important.
I'm glad you did.
And that's it. I had a phase where I was just at every event, because for me, it's multiple touch points in sales. And that's what it is. We're in a sales and service role. People will see you online. They may not be ready. They may not fully trust you. They meet you in person. They see your good energy. And there's that connection. Or they meet you in person, and then the first thing they do when they get home is check out your social media, make sure you're legit, and there's that trust built. It's cyclical. They have to link together. So I think if you had just a social media only policy, you'll get very far, but not as far as if it was socials, online, but also offline networking. And even with the offline stuff, it's not just going to property events. If you go to a non-property event, you're probably the only person who does what you do in that room. So you'll stand out a lot more. But then back to socials, take content, document where you are, who you're with, what you learn. It's back and forth. You have to do both. I don't think you can get away with just one or the other. But the reason I do it and I continue to do it is, I have a small business. I'm in South Wales. Finance is very London-centric. It's very Canary Wharf-centric. So for me to make a space or make a name in that industry, I have to do it. And what's funny is when I go to a lot of the London events with other brokers and finance people, they're always like, we recognize you from LinkedIn. We love what you do. Keep doing it. Because for them, it's so alien, this way of lead generation, because they have introducers, they have solicitors or accountants to give them big business. They don't need to be doing what I do. But, each to their own, I guess.
It is definitely sort of different in the industry, right? Like you said, it's a more creative, maybe modern way of doing it as well, which is cool. It's inspired us like a lot when you talked about it and when we saw you as well, just because with what we're doing, like it's all about relationships, like with anything, right? So the more relationships we can build, the better, and it's a great avenue. Like you said, it's not the only avenue. We do a lot of in-person networking and we love that, but we know that that's another thing which we're starting to do obviously with this as well, which is great.
The thing you said is so true about the I love that you said it was about the people that are in the middle there. And I call them, there's like the three type of people. You got buyers in power, buyers in need, and then you got tire kickers. So you have people that will message you, they'll look at all your stuff and they won't do anything. But then you have the buyers in need, which I might get these mixed up, but the buyer in need is the one where you, they'll see your content and they'll be like, I need to buy. Like they'll buy a red shirt, black shirt, yellow shirt, everything off you. And the buyers are the ones that you need convincing, and they're the ones that will look at your social media for like a year or a couple of months. And we had this recently where one of our clients, they were, they saw some of our podcasts, they saw some of our social media stuff, they saw that we're doing well, and they said, "Hey, I saw your stuff. You look like you're doing really well. I have a house I want to do SA. Can you come look?" And then, you know, it became a client, and that was just simply from, and we weren't even that consistent. It was just a post that they saw 2 months ago. So if that compounds, it's crazy. So I love that you said that.
100%. I think also that some people like to test the waters. So I've had some people who are now big clients of mine, but initially it's a bit of back and forth, a little bit of flirting, a little bit of, hey, just a quick question. And then also a little bit of, hey, my friend needs a mortgage. Can you help them to see how, you know, I operate? And they always start you off with the small, dirty deal. You do that well, they then trust you with the bigger deals, which is fine. And I enjoy that. I enjoy the challenge.
And it's like giving value, I think, so important. Like you said, it's, you know, what you're saying about like in the Facebook groups, but in general, the more you're there to help people, the more you get back. It's got to be that way around, doesn't it? And people see that as well.
Yeah. As long as you're doing it from a place of, as long as you're genuine about it, you know, I can't remember the last time I've done a post or anything where I put at the bottom and call me or DM me, because the call to action is the content, is the value, right? You don't need to be then also saying, please call me.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, we used to work at a big social media, you know, marketing kind of company, and it was for fitness. And there was always the saying, it was like 90% value, 10% selling. And the 10% selling is just basically people messaging you or you putting maybe like, if you want to know more information, just let me know. I'm here to help. But the value is what sells. But a lot of people out there, and I think so many people out there just selling just courses or selling information or just like sell. And the nature of humans, we don't want to be sold. So like we hate it. We truly hate it. Like we get icky.
Yeah. I mean, you say that, Zach. I think I was talking about this on other content as well, is it's supply and demand. We don't want to be sold to, but we also want to get rich quick. So if someone says, you know, I can do this for you, it's crazy. Even now in 2024, when, you know, there should be more information, there should be more grounded, people are still getting sold all these silly courses, which, it always baffles me how people are not clued up to it.
I agree. And you're so true there on the people want the quick fix, and they're quick to be sold. But they don't want to be sold to, but when they see something that is like, oh my God, that's exactly what I want, they're quick to buy, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Which is crazy.
The
hook. Yeah. Yeah, sure. The hook. Yeah. How long have you been doing social media for now? Did you start it straight away when you went full time, or did it gradually come like full time in your business?
I think, it just tied in with when I went self employed. So, 6 years ago, maybe? But even then, I think it wasn't intentional, but even then I started off as it was always been Where's Shaz. It was never Shaz Mortgage Broker or Shaz Finance. I'm trying to think, why did I do that? But I think it was more because of the networking, and everyone was saying, oh, Where's Shaz? Okay, that's my Instagram handle. I think that puts me in a good position because I can then branch out. I can host networking events. I've done an event recently. I can do different things. Because my handle isn't Shaz Finance or Shaz the Mortgage Broker. It's quite generic.
Yeah, so true. So what are some tips that you would give someone? Actually, I'll rephrase that. Like, let's say someone right now is wanting to start their property journey. Uh-huh. What would you tell them that they need to be doing? Because I guarantee they're on the fence and they're terrified. How would you help them if they were to ask you that question?
Do you mean from a social media perspective or just generally investing?
Social media perspective. Okay. Yeah.
So first thing is, get on a page, be clear on what your values are and your brand is. Also realize that your brand just isn't a color or isn't a logo, and isn't a blazer that you wear and it's the same collection. That is just, those are gimmicks. You know, it's ultimately you are the brand. And then just post, because it's free. A lot of people are like, oh yeah, I can't post yet because I've not had my first deal. Yeah, but you know, document the journey. Like, people want to know what you're up to, who you're meeting on your way to succeeding. And that's where people will resonate with you, is, you know, I can connect with this person because I'm in the same situation, or I was in the same situation, as opposed to I've now got 5 deals and the journey is more important than the destination, because when you get there, what you can do now, you know, you've achieved what you want to achieve. collaborations are really important. Yeah. And guys, what you, I know because I met you at networking, I saw you with other people. People love working with other people. It takes the load off of you having to be front and center if you're that kind of person. And collaborations are key because you'll have the shared audience, but you'll have the audience that you don't know or don't know you yet that will also suddenly be aware of you. So collaborations are very important, as long as it's win-win. What you bring to the table and what are they doing? And I think just do the free work. So social media is free. And also you jump on, give the value for free. Now, there's a sales coach that I follow, Daniel G. He's from Canada. He's amazing. Follow him, guys. And he says, you know, you get paid heavily in the future for the free stuff you do today. So if you do free webinars, free training, free coaching, in the future, you get paid to do that stuff, you know, and it seems easy. Consistency is a good one because people do have like a small memory, unfortunately. So, you know, you could be the person now, but if you don't post for 6 months, people will forget. So you've got to kind of keep yourself out there and just tell people what you're doing. It does sound simple. But I was also that person who didn't want to be on camera or didn't want to put my face out there. And that was just because of my own insecurities. I remember I went to a seminar by Saj Hussain from the Midlands. And he just said, not to me directly, thankfully, but he said, you know, if you're concerned about how you look or how you sound on camera, then just get over yourself, because ultimately it's the content and the value that is way more important than how you look or how you present. As long as what you're saying is genuinely valuable, that's what will attract people. And also, yeah, I think, yeah, I'll tell you, this is the one that maybe people don't say, is lean in to your uniqueness. Everyone's got a different thing about them. So my thing, and things can change. My thing used to be, I used to be a massive foodie because I had my burger restaurant. I used to love burgers and desserts and things. So I talk about that a lot. I talk about, you know, I'm here having this meal today and just kind of sprinkle in my weirdness, right? We all have these weird things about us. Do more of that because that'll make you be more human and not just someone who's clearly sales funneling and doing that. So yeah, definitely lean into what makes you different.
Yeah, so that's the authenticity of it, isn't it? It's like being honest, like you said about sharing the journey as well. There's so much pressure on social media to be a certain thing, be a certain way, but actually what works is sharing, like you said, the journey, not just pretending you're already there when you're not, and trying to show up in a certain way. You don't have to, do you? It's not actually what people want to see.
Yeah. I came up with a phrase. I said it, and then I Googled it, and no one else has claimed it, so I'm claiming it. Right, it's that don't fake it until you make it, but instead believe it until you achieve it. So be the person that you'd want to see, and then you'll get there in the end. I think if you do something consistently long enough over a long enough time, you'll definitely achieve it in the end. But you have to keep doing it, and you have to keep showing what you're doing to people as well.
I love that saying. And do you know what I can't remember who it was. I heard someone say this and it really resonated with me. It's like the queen was the most known and most popular person in the world, and everyone in every corner of the world knew her. I couldn't even tell you when she passed away, and I don't remember the last time I thought of her. So why anyone care you posting on social media if they're going to... No one, you're forgotten. So if someone sees it and they comment, they're going to forget about you. So the people that are actually looking and commenting and going to be following you, they're the ones that actually care. And it's like that.
And
that
even then,
resonates with me.
Right.
Yeah. I think that was.
I didn't hear what you said.
Right, I think it's lagging. I just said, and even the ones that are following you, like, there's only so much that you can compare. Like you said, Charles, I still forget about you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. 100%. Yeah.
But I believe that quote about the queen was from Alex Hormozy. I think it's on a podcast. I've heard it. So yeah, he drops.
You're right. Good. Nice. On it.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, social media's funny. Like, the other thing as well is similar to any business, don't let your business control you. Same way, don't let social media control you. If you need a break or whatever, just have a break. But just be beneficial. Just know what the benefits are. It's free. It's free advertising. Free distribution. And I read in Gary V's new book that, and I agree with it, is that a lot of these channels, especially Instagram now, is becoming a lot like TikTok, where even a small new account could post a video and get hundreds of thousands of views. And I've seen it happen. You Yeah. And like TikTok, the trickle-down effect doesn't happen, so you don't get the followers off of it. They just look at your video and move on. But it's very much possible now to get a lot of attention, for even for a small account. So take advantage, because these algorithms always change. But right now, you can be a brand new account and get a lot of engagement and views on the good content.
Yeah, that's so true. So we had somebody at a networking event. They did a video playing jazz to a cow, and it got like 2 million views.
Wow. Takes.
And I know, obviously, there's not much power in that, but it's still like 2 million views. It's like what the hell?
Just demonstrates
the power of social media. But no, Chaz, like, this has been fantastic. There's so much knowledge bombs in here. So where is Chaz in 3 years? Let's play off that word.
Well, let's have a look. So
My
goals and ambitions do change and are quite fluid. I'd want a bigger team. I'd want more brokers. I've got one broker on board already, which is great. It's taken ages to get someone. Awesome. I want maybe two or three more in the specialist space. We don't need that many people in because it's specialist, but two or three more brokers, a few more admin, so I could start stepping to the side a little bit. I'd probably see myself doing these side quests, doing more networking events, hosting them, doing more kind of consultancy type stuff to help other brokers build their businesses through social media. I'd still be in the business. I like problem solving, so which is why I enjoy doing what I do. So when someone comes to me with a creative problem, I want to be given that solution. I see myself slightly sidestepping with more brokers doing what I do, and then me building out other things. Yeah, like, it sounds weird to say, guys, but like, property itself isn't my passion. Helping people is. So if I can help people some other way, I'd jump at that chance.
Yeah, that's epic. I love it. Mate, honestly, it's been a privilege having you on here. You have been a massive knowledge bomb on finance, and even just talking about your journey on social. So you're on Instagram, yeah? So where is Chaz? That's your hashtag, that's your tag. Are you on any other platforms? Any YouTube or
Instagram, Donnie's? Facebook, LinkedIn, where's Chaz? Everywhere. I'm on TikTok as well, but I need to have a strategy for TikTok, because sharing Instagram stuff over there doesn't work.
Yeah. Well, look, mate, it's been a pleasure. I'm sure we'll catch up soon, and all the best. Keep smashing it. Yeah, where Shaz is everywhere now. we'll do it again. Thank you so much for being on here. It's been an absolute pleasure, and have a great day.
Thanks so much.
No worries. Thank you.
Thanks, Shaz.